Ben Smith, I'm a photographer, and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers. Thanks for listening. Hello people, this is Ben and this is my podcast, A Small Voice, Conversations with Photographers, in which I chat with some of the most talented and inspirational image makers out there about their work, their practice, their lives, their careers and anything else that comes up. This week I'm really pleased to welcome the esteemed photojournalist and documentary photographer Ed Casci. As usual, I'll do the intro properly in a minute, but before that, it's important to mention that this episode of the podcast is sponsored by a charcoal book club, the world's first book of the month club, dedicated exclusively to photo books. So the way it works is that each month, Charcoal works with the most respected photographers and publishers in the industry to send hand-picked books directly to your door. So whether you are a professional artist or a photographer with a stock library or a novice who's just beginning to build their collection, Charcoal Book Club is an easy and affordable way to stay up to date on the most essential work in contemporary photography. The club offers free shipping to the UK, Canada and the US, and members get exclusive perks such as signed copies, access to rare titles, members-only pricing in their online bookstore and more. So, as an example, this month's photo book is Guts by Masaki Yamamoto. This is a highly anticipated first photo book, which presents one of the most daring family portraits in Japanese photography. Shot entirely in his family's tiny apartment, with walls yellowed from cigarette smoke, broken doors, and trash covering the ground, Yamamoto's unashamed, uncompromising black and white photos nonetheless depict a strong and rare sense of familial intimacy and affection. Not quite dysfunctional, but decidedly atypical. And he says, "As we grew up, we had different experiences of being bullied, socially withdrawn, sick, badly behaved, and so on. These experiences intertwined with the Yamamoto family's history and are what makes up our lives as well as the family's bonds together." So, you know, the obvious reference point for this book is, of course, Richard Billingham's Raids of Laugh. It's almost like superficially looks almost like a black and white Japanese version of that book, if you're familiar with it. But of course, it will not be. It will be its own thing. And I don't know that much about Japanese photographers. It's something I need to rectify because there are many, many good ones. And I know nothing about Masaki Yamamoto at all. And if it wasn't for the Charcoal Book Club, that would remain the case. But soon I will have a signed first edition of that debut book, which I'm totally pumped about getting through the post. So you see how it works, right? You get the genius of it. I thought you would. So yet again, Charcoal are extending a very special introductory offer exclusively to Small Voice listeners when you sign up. Any book from their extensive library for free. Go to charcoalbookclub.com and use the special code of Small Voice when you sign up to receive your free book. For the latest and greatest photo books, including Japanese ones, delivered to your door with free shipping and no hassles, check out thecharcoalbookclub.com. On a mission to inform the mind and inspire the soul, which they're certainly doing, for me at least anyway, and no doubt for other customers of theirs. I really do think you guys should look into the whole thing and check out charcoalbookclub.com. If you do like the podcast, please do take a minute to leave a very brief but glowing review on iTunes to help enable other like-minded souls to discover it. Please consider joining my other lovely but all too select band of patrons by signing up for a small recurring monthly subscription or make a larger one-off or occasional donation at bensmithphoto.com/a small voice. Nearly forgot my own web address then. And if you're in need of a new website but don't have the time, the inclination or the aptitude to build it yourself, let me know. I'll do it for you, using the brilliant Squarespace, who still inexplicably don't sponsor this podcast, but I am working on it. Finally, come on, England. So the brilliant Ed Casci is a critically acclaimed, award-winning photojournalist, filmmaker, speaker, and educator who for 40 years has dedicated himself to documenting many of the social and geopolitical issues that define our times. A sensitive eye and an intimate relationship to his subjects are signatures of his work. A member of the Seven Agency since 2010, Ed has been recognised for his complex imagery and its compelling rendering of the human condition. In addition to editorial assignments, filmmaking and personal projects, Ed is a mentor to students of photography and an active participant in forums and lectures on photojournalism, documentary photography and multimedia. His early adoption of hybrid visual storytelling has produced a number of influential short films. Additionally, his editorial assignments and personal projects have generated 8 books, including Curse of the Black Gold, 50 Years of Oil in the Niger Delta, 3, and Witness Number 8, Photojournalisms. In 2002, Ed, in partnership with his wife, the writer and filmmaker Julie Winokur, founded Talking Eyes Media, a non-profit company which has subsequently produced numerous award-winning short films, exhibits, books and multimedia pieces that explore, I don't know what's wrong with my voice today, guys, I really am so sorry, significant social issues. Maybe it's hay fever. They're currently engaged in a five-year storytelling project with Rutgers University in Newark called Newest Americans, focused on immigration, for which they recently received a two-year grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. It was so great to get to chat with Ed, not only one of the best there is, not only a man with 40 years of experience in the field, but just one of the nicest guys you could ever wish to meet. And as you're about to find out, there's tons of gold in this chat, despite the fact we only had limited amount of time amid his many commitments during some workshops that seven members were running in Barcelona early in the year. So enjoy this one, Ed Cashy. Bring that nice and close to your mouth, Ed. That's brilliant.
God, I love audio.
Yeah.
As a photographer, like discovering audio is like like a whole new universe opens up.
Yeah. It's another thing I think to experiment with, isn't it?
Well, especially as a storyteller, because, well, you know, or as a filmmaker, you bring the voices of your subjects, you know, which is something I appreciate.
Yeah.
It's not some like American guy telling you what's going on in these places. I can have the people from those places tell their story, and my images are the window into them,
right,
their world, you know.
Well, it very much goes hand in hand with photography, I think, audio. And it's because, you know, well, I was going to actually, funnily enough, I was going to start asking you about that, because at these workshops, you're doing quite a lot of video based stuff. Is that something that's much more in demand now these days among young photographers, do you think?
Well, I think photographers of all ages, really, but video is definitely increasingly like the lingua franca in a way of the world. I mean, that seems to be what everyone is indicating, you know, that the media companies, even though they don't have money to pay for it, that, you know, video gets the most hits. Video is just very popular. But beyond what the market dictates or indicates, as a storyteller, video has allowed me to expand the range of how I can tell stories. Mm. And it's allowed me to tell stories that are not necessarily visual, because as a photographer and a storyteller, there are lots of stories and issues I care about, but it's impossible to visualize them.
Right.
With video and audio, you can now do that. You can bring it to life.
Right. Okay. So you need a higher standard of visual appeal with stills than you do with shooting video.
The onus on still photography now is much greater. I mean, it was never easy.
Mm.
You know, it's easy to make a good picture, but to make great pictures, or to make a great photo essay, or a great, you know, project that you spend years on, that's another level of execution. And I still believe in that medium. I still believe in that form of creativity and storytelling. It would be heartbreaking to think that went away from the sort of human lexicon, the human language.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, I don't know about the technology, but I was wondering if maybe at some point in the future, you know, people will just grab stills from the actual video footage, you know, in other words, the need to shoot stills will kind of almost, I hope it doesn't happen, but I'm wondering if that might possibly happen in the future.
Well, I mean, yes, the shooting 4K or beyond, and then still frame grab, but then we're going to need new editing software, because if I have a session with you and I end up shooting, what, tens of thousands of frames,
because
I've shot 10 minutes of video or whatever the numbers are, how the heck do you find that image? And beyond that, it's the whole, it just goes against the whole idea of what still photography is. Mm. And I'm not saying that in some like old fashioned way. It's just in the same way that the experience of creating still photography is so unique to media, the absorption, the viewing of still photography is unique, that experience. And I fear we're losing it in this age of, you know, being thumbstruck.
Yeah.
Where you're just scrolling, boom, your thumb, you're thumbstruck, you stop. How long do you stop for?
Mm.
depending on the kind of viewer you are. And I remember, I've talked about this because it's recently, it hit me. I was in India a couple of years ago, and I remember I was lying in bed one morning. I was thinking, you know, man, so much of my early education of the world, this was way before I ever was a photographer, was looking through like old picture magazines and really absorbing them and looking at the image and reading the caption and reading the text and looking at the image and learning so much detail. And I would hate to think that we would lose that.
Yeah, no, I know exactly what you mean. And I was thinking just the other day, in fact, looking at images on the screen just isn't the same as looking at an actual image, a printed image. I know that's a sort of...
No, that's old farty, buddy.
Old, yeah, but isn't that what you're talking about in a way?
No, because I can look at an image on a screen. I think maybe to not agree or disagree, but to pick up on what you're saying is that the nature by which we absorb information on screens tends to be a bit rushed.
Mm.
And, you know, because of screens and the sort of horizontal ways we can like hit a link and then go to something else, it's creating a different way of absorbing information, right? Like, right. I could be reading an article in the New York Times about something, and then there's a link that then takes me to some historical context about this current day story. And if I go there, then you're in that rabbit hole,
yeah.
Right? Whereas if you're reading a magazine or, you know, print, if you're looking at print, you're sort of stuck, for better or worse.
Mm. In front of the thing, yeah.
In front of that thing. But it forces you, it's like meditation. It forces you to stop, to think, to look, question. This whole, you know, digital experience of information absorption, while it's magnificent in some ways, I don't know. It's a crazy moment.
You were... an early advocate of video, though. You are sort of thought as one of the pioneers, really. What appealed to you initially, and was there a lot of resistance to it among your peers?
Yeah, it's interesting because it seems so quaint and naive now. The initial reason for doing it was so I've been shooting video for 18 years now. I began in 2000, and it was just halfway through our 8-year project looking at aging in America. And it was 3 or 4 years into that project, and I'm working, you know, old school black and white Leica film. And I had this, like, what I thought was this revolutionary idea. Wouldn't it be cool for the exhibition by the Silver Gelatin Prince to have a screen with one of the subjects talking? Which seemed like mind-blowing then. Now, of course, it's idiotically simple, but that's the feeling I had then. And so I thought, okay, I want to learn to shoot video. Initially, it went as far as just doing basically what we would now call A-roll interviews, you know, talking heads.
Hmm.
And so that's where it began.
Right.
And then... I didn't realize it, but I opened this new world for me, audio, you know, the whole exploration of the soundscape around me. And then I would find there are times where I'd be out as a still photographer in the world and I would hear something and I'd be like, oh my God, that's so much more interesting than whatever picture I'm going to make. You know, so anyway, learning video and audio opened me up to new ways of telling stories.
Right. And it is all about the stories at the end of the day for you, is it?
And the issue. Story is an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's what I'm driven by, is kind of narrative and increasingly the issue.
Yeah.
Because increasingly it's, and part of this, I think, is the age and stage I'm at, is how can I contribute something to the world that's meaningful? And I don't mean to sound like a jerk, but I really sincerely mean that.
Mm.
While I love photography and I love imagery and I love indulging in the aesthetics and the artistic elements of it, the craftsmanship of it, more than ever. There, you know, whatever time I have left, I want to have impact.
Mm. So you're still as full of enthusiasm for it and drive for it as always, by the sound of things, ever.
Yeah, but it's also tempered with age and fatigue. I mean, I've been cranking for 40 years,
mm.
40 years. And so I'm realizing I'm hitting walls, excuse me, where while I can do it, if I'm not careful, besides whatever, you know, breakdown might happen physically, emotionally, psychologically, I'm not, there's a danger of not enjoying it as much because you're just burnt out. And this would go for anything in life, you know? So I'm realizing now that I need to not pull back, but just be, it would take a little time, more time for myself.
Yeah.
You know, it's part of the freelancer's dilemma also.
Yeah, so you've got a couple of different things to try and balance out all at once, but you don't want it to get to a point where, you know, you're really not enjoying it at all anymore.
Yeah.
So I guess that's the main...
Well, I don't know how heavy you want to get.
Oh, heavy as you like, up to you.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, so last month, okay, here's an example of where I feel like I really just hit a wall, which both my wife and I knew were coming, and it was, I think she sort of worries constantly, when is she going to get that call, or when is that going to happen? And so last month, I went to Peru for 3 weeks to continue to do the next segment of my chronic kidney disease project. It's in its fifth year. I have a grant from the National Geographic Society. I'm living the dream. My own project. I've got a grant. I'm in Peru. Yet I'm waking up every morning, and literally, I just want to die. I'm not suicidal, but I mean, like, I would wake up and I just think, I'm exhausted. I have nothing left. And then I'm thinking, you asshole, you're like, you're living the dream. And so, you know, I it was pretty dark, and I realized, okay, man, you need to take steps now. You need to take steps to sort of rehab yourself. Thankfully, it's not from drugs or anything like that. It's something I can actually take in control of.
Right, right.
But, you know, and I don't know, you know, you could maybe hit that at any age. I mean, obviously, the older one gets, the more susceptible you are to these sorts of walls or breakdowns. And you know, part of it is learning to take better, give more time to myself, because what I don't want to have happen, to sort of circle back to what you were saying, is that... when I'm in that situation where I'm doing exactly what I want to do, I need to be 100% or 150%, not 50%, because I'm tired or I'm depressed or all the human things most of us struggle with.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that throws up so many questions in my head. I mean, partly the fact that you've got so much experience is what allows you to see the need, as it were, to deal with something, whereas I guess when you're younger, you might be more inclined to be harder on yourself if you find yourself in that position. But what are the steps that you think need to be taken to?
Oh boy, go on, this becomes a okay. I didn't know I was going on Oprah. No, I'm joking.
No, we like, this is the stuff we like.
Well, I tell you, I mean, I hate to ever feel that one becomes narcissistic in these moments, but on the other hand, I also feel, you know, I have 40 years of experience, and there are things that I can relate to people that I hope can give them something they can take away for their own lives, their own practice, their own work, you know, so that they can mitigate these things or learn to avoid them, you know? But no, I mean, I started to speak to a therapist a few weeks ago for the first time in years. I, you know, I'm doing yoga. I signed up for a screenwriting class.
All right.
Because I have this dream. I want to write a screenplay about something very in particular. And so I thought, you know, man, why not? Like this, let's start using different parts of yourself.
Right.
You know, like if I wanted to, carpentry would probably be the thing, or biking, or something that is not about photography. You know, now again, I've chosen something so far that's very close. It's still storytelling.
Right.
But it's writing.
A different discipline, yeah.
And I originally wanted to be a writer before I discovered photography. So anyway, I'm going to take a retreat in upstate New York next month for a week in a cabin. I'm just trying to sort of, you know, pull back on the throttle a little bit, not turn the machine off, just pull back on the throttle. You know, I don't know if you feel this way, but, you know, could be at any age. You know, we're living in this moment where, especially because of the smartphones, but in general, on social media, that you literally can never turn off if you're not careful. And that can have a cumulative impact on us, you know. And social media in particular can be quite pernicious. It can be very destructive. And it can, if you have any self-destructive tendencies, it can really... you know, it can really feed into that. And so I think what I'm trying to do now is just take a little bit of a step back from this precipice and, you know, just find a little space to ruminate, daydream, exercise different parts of myself. Because right. I know then that I will circle back to my work and I'll be that much stronger, I'll be that much smarter.
So you just need to recharge your batches and recharge your creative, you know, juices. I suppose if you're trying to work and you're depleted, then you're not going to do good work, I suppose.
Yep. And to pick up on that, and this sort of really vectors into another part of the conversation I would hope we would touch upon is, so for instance, I'm in Peru just because this is a real, you know, just a couple weeks old situation. I'm asking people who are sick to let me into their lives. Like, what an asshole if I do that and then I'm not 100% there.
Right.
Because those, on some level, those people don't need another guy, another person with a camera. You know, so I better have a damn good reason to be getting into their lives. And then I need to treat that with, you know, dignity and respect and the sort of preciousness of this opportunity that they're giving me. And if I'm not at 100%, there's something not good about that. I can give you another example if you...
Please do, yeah.
Okay. So in 2008, I was working on a story about Arab Christians in the Middle East. And this was probably like April. So I was we're in Damascus, and we're interviewing people who have gone through the most horrific experiences in Iraq, where, you know, multiple family members have been killed or tortured, and, you know, they've made it out. And they're recounting this. Well, in January of that year, my father-in-law had died, and he had lived, you know, we moved back to the East Coast to care for him the last 2 years of his life. So I had just gone through, it was a beautiful experience, but quite an emotional experience where, you know, our last elder had died in our home with us around him. And I'm sitting there, and this young Iraqi man is telling me these horrific tales. And all I'm thinking about is, like, I can't wait to get back to the hotel room. I want to take a nap. And then I'm thinking, you asshole. Like, this guy has gone through something so much more horrific than you've just experienced. But what it taught me, again, it's like what I'm going through now, is you've got to make sure you're 100%. You have to take care of yourself physically, emotionally, and psychologically so that if you are able to get into these moments, especially with the kind of work I do and the issues I care about, that you're at the top of your game.
Right. Yeah, you kind of owe it to your subjects in a way.
Exactly.
Yeah. Actually, it's funny, you've mentioned it already, but have you tried meditation? Is that one of the things?
Oh my God, you're like my wife. No, I was like, my wife, my sister, everybody says that. Try meditation.
Look, I don't know what it is, but...
Can we do it now? That's dead air time.
No, yeah, that would be really boring radio, audio, but...
You could describe what... You're like,
I wrote the question down, and what made me think that? I don't know. It seems like you are someone who's good at, you know, the inner life, as it were. And I just thought, I bet Ed's tried a bit of mindfulness meditation.
Yeah. Well, again, it's uncanny. I guess I should start to listen, because so many people say this to me, but that's partly the issue of slowing down enough to even allow myself to consider it. Mm. At this point, if I read a book, that's like meditation. And I'm not joking.
Right, because you're working so often, or there are other commitments, you know, family and everything.
Just the brain. The brain is going again because of these damn smartphones and the way we're living and the 24/7 nature and in particularly the kind of work I'm in, the field I'm in. Mm. It just seems this constant state of connection, which on the one hand is beautiful, you know, because I could be anywhere in the world and be connected to my kids or my wife or my friends or you know, the seven agency folks, you know, whatever, I can be connected. But I think it's unhealthy to not disconnect and be with yourself and be still and be calm and feel. It's not just about like being able to like be alone with yourself. Sure, that's important. But it's just the state of calmness, I think, it's dangerous if we lose that.
Mm. And, you know, the nature of the work that you do is not like, you know, you're just, I mean, you're very much a photojournalist, and that's the work you've always done and for a long period of time. So, you know, that's a massive factor. I mean, how much of an issue is dealing with the emotional fallout from just the kind of relentless awfulness, I suppose, is as good a word as any.
Well, there's a, definitely a cumulative impact. There's no question of, you know, witnessing whatever, a lot of pain, suffering, violence, death. You know, and I've worked in conflict zones a fair bit, but I'm not a war photographer, but I've seen enough to, it has a cumulative impact unless you're just such a cold fish or you're just superhuman and you, yeah. You know, I always think of like nurses or even school teachers, but you know, nurses and doctors, but particularly nurses who for, you know, if you do it for decades, it's like, oh my God, and you're not burnt out. And you're not cynical. It's amazing. So I think, you know, in this profession, it's the same thing. There's the chance for burnout.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, you know, you're helping people in a very direct way if you're a nurse. And that's the kind of compensation. And as a photojournalist, you may well be helping people, but it's a much less direct.
Yeah.
But, I mean, one of the expressions that you used was image and experience fatigue. That was something that I wanted to ask you about. How would you describe that? I mean, what is that?
Well, I think it's a numbness. It's like where you have, like I've sort of described, you know, you have these moments where you're in situ, you're in the moment, right? This is like what you dream of, or you work so hard to, like you're an athlete and you've trained and you get to the Olympics and the starter gun goes off and then you're like, what am I doing here? Or, you know, or I can't run or I can't get out of the starting blocks. It's not quite that dramatic, but it's that sort of thing where, you know, it's anything I think that you do in life where you engage with the public or your work is constantly has you engaged with things. There is the chance of getting numb, and that I am so sensitive, and the thought of being numb, it freaks me out. You know, just the idea that I would ever get cold or not care, I'd have to stop doing this.
Yeah.
You know.
What motivates you to carry on then? Is it, are you angry at the injustice that there is in the world, or, you know, what?
Well, that's really an interesting question, because, especially at this moment, because in general, I am fueled by, you know, either a passionate, either an anger or a belief that there's an issue or an injustice that I want to learn more about. I want to find a way to tell a story about, to raise awareness, and now increasingly to be a part of that change, right? And but it's really interesting because of what's happening in the moment today, from sort of the Agent Orange phenomenon in America to you got that one right.
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. You know, things happening in Europe and all over the world, really. It's a strange, dark time, it feels, in certain ways. Sometimes it's hard to know, what can I actually be effective with now?
Right.
You know, I sincerely, like, it's a dilemma. I mean, if there's one thing that is a sort of hallmark of my career and my work, or my way of working, it's proposing ideas and either getting them accepted from the editorial world or the NGO world or grants, right? And while that continues, thankfully, it's much harder now to go, you know, like for years I thought, I'm going to bridge the gap between Islam and the West by going to the Middle East and telling stories, right?
Right.
What was I thinking?
Well, it's an honorable intention.
I know, but given what's happened.
Right, yeah.
You know, it's like, yeah. You know what I'm trying to say. I mean, it's like, so what it's sort of forced me to do, or the way I'm dealing with it now, is it's not so much scaling back ambitions, but trying to be much smarter, more strategic with my ambitions. So that's why, like, this project I'm working on now on chronic kidney disease of unknown origins, while it's not a very sexy topic, it's underreported. It has the potential to explode into a global epidemic. Some might say it already is, but it's, you know, underdiagnosed as well. And like, okay, this one I can tackle.
Right.
And again, super important for people listening who want to do this is having the right partners, meaning the right advocates and the right NGOs or foundations or whatever individuals or organizations, you know, epidemiologists, doctors that can take my work and then use it to advocate for change.
So you're much more considered about what you can, where you can be effective in a way. Is that kind of
exactly
the gist of it? Yeah,
exactly. Now, having said that, I love making pictures and I love telling stories. So, you know, like I recently was commissioned by a corporation to do something in India, you know, about the cashless man of India. You know, it was basically branded content.
Right.
Right. So I was paid well to do something, but it was still storytelling. So, but it was great. It was like so cool. It was so much fun. And I think we actually did a really nice job. But now if that's all I did, I would not be happy with that because I want to deal. There is nothing like working as a photojournalist or documentary photographer, filmmaker, where you're working in, I guess, the editorial documentary vein. You know, that's fundamentally different than doing branded content or commercial work, obviously, or corporate work. So what I'm trying to say is that I still love the craftsmanship of creation, whether it's still photography or making films. So in some ways, I'm more open now to doing a broader range of commissions.
Right.
But if it's my own work, or I am going to get out the door and go someplace, whether it's around the block or around the world, I want it to be something that I feel I can really have an impact with. And another example of that now is this work I'm doing with my wife, Julie Winoker, and Talking Eyes Media, the production company that she runs, with Rutgers University in Newark. It's called Newest Americans, and we're 3.5 years into that project, and it's all about immigration, something I am also very passionate about. So that's an example of where in a much bigger sense, like we're in our fourth year on this, and we've gotten some huge funding for it, and it's academic, it's editorial, it's involves students, it involves faculty, it involves people in the community. So, you know, there's different ways to sort of tackle this beast.
Was that something you founded together, that production company, or it's a non-profit, isn't it?
Yeah, Talking Eyes Media.
Talking Eyes, yeah.
Yeah, so Julie and I found that in 2002 in San Francisco. We were just finishing the project on aging, and it had been the first time in our careers where we received, you know, significant grant money so that we could work outside of the media system. But we realized you needed to have a fiscal agent, at least in the United States, so that means they take anywhere from 5 to 15% of your grant, and then you have to pay taxes on it.
Right.
So a $100,000 grant, you know, suddenly 40, 50,000 of it is gone. Right. So now that's not profit. That's just $40,000 less for field work. So we were like, so on a practical level, and then almost like an ethos sort of spiritual thing, it made sense to create a nonprofit. So then we could go directly for grants and then not have to pay a fiscal agent and not have to pay taxes and then use all of that money to create our work.
Mm.
And so now whatever this is 16 years later, you know, Julie is the executive director of it, and ironically, it mostly survives more on commissions, but also now these big grants for Newest Americans, this very specific project. So yeah, it's sort of, we have our own production company, which is great for me. I'm very fortunate for the filmmaker part of my work, because now I can totally abuse them. Right. No, anyway.
Yeah. Well, you're perfectly placed to, you know, take advantage of that having already been, you know, that sort of infrastructure set up.
But there's a problem. Now she's too busy with her own work.
All right.
Yeah, okay. So I was like, I'm begging. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, you're away half the time anyway, aren't you?
Well, now it's 8 months out of the year.
Right. You've talked very kind of, very touchingly about the whole subject, I think, of how one has to deal with, how one deals with these, you know, with being away and family. And in fact, you did a book, which was called Photojournalisms, and that featured some of your journal entries. Have you always journaled? Was that something that goes back to the beginning?
Yeah, so this is something that I began doing, actually, even before I met Julie, She knows that this is not going to destroy our marriage. There's many other reasons why. Sorry, no.
Well, being away for 8 months.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, maybe that helps. I don't know.
I don't know. So this is something that I began to do probably in like the late 80s with, actually I had been briefly married before, but basically this is something that I began to do because I'm someone who, I mean, it's so ironic. I spend so much time on the road, but I really need to be connected. I'm not some cowboy independent person. I'm actually quite a, I want to be connected to not anybody, you know, but to the people I love and I'm close to. So this was a way in the analog days of staying connected in some way where I would arrive in a place. I think I started doing it in the late 80s in Northern Ireland when I worked for 3 years on a project there and I was living in San Francisco. And my then wife, you know, I would collect a nice book, a little diary, and I would make notes every day. And it was my way to sort of, this is pre-email and now texting, where I could feel like it's not only stay in touch, but I could relate. You know, it's like when something happens to you in your life and you want to tell your best friend, you wouldn't believe what I saw today. Well, it was that kind of thing.
Right.
Oh my God, I went to this demonstration in Barcelona and blah, blah, blah. Or I met this person and, you know, she's amazing. And this is what I learned. It was that idea of I'm a share. I'm a total TMI person.
Right.
And so that was a funnel for me to do that. And then I met Julie and then, you know, serious love and then kids and truly building a life together. We're now 25 years into this that I continue to do that with her in a much more, like I would actually start to take notes during the day because often you'd end days and feel so mentally tired that I was afraid I'd forget things. Anyway, and so this is what I did. And so after almost 20 years of doing that, I thought, well, let's look at what we have here. And that's where photojournalism was created from. The sort of sad and ironic thing is after the book was published and we made a film, I stopped writing journals.
Oh, really? It was almost like you'd kind of, I don't know, somehow put a full stop on the end of it, or inadvertently perhaps.
Yeah, well, I think it represented a passing in time, like, you know, to a new phase. And also maybe I was tired of repeating myself.
Right.
You know, I'm not, you know, Yeats, you know, sort of like, but I think in a way that put that project put closure on that. And quite frankly, I can text her 24/7.
Right, right.
So that's part of it.
The technology has made it a different ball game.
Yeah.
I guess that's helped. I mean, is there a sense in which being away so much has helped? I mean, absence making the heart go fonder and all that stuff. I mean, obviously there's two sides to it, but how have you guys managed to deal with it for so long, you know, that dynamic? Especially, I guess, with once you had kids and you know, that really changes that very much because, you know, then you must be really missing them a lot when you're away. And yet, you know, you continue to go.
I don't know. It's well, first of all, the way we've been able to make it work is because of Julie, because I lucked out that I found a mate that was willing to, you know, put up with this. Was willing to accept that this is who I am and this is what I have to do. Mm-hmm. And this is really important for all, not just men, but all mates out there. Listen to your mate. So when they complain and when they say they're tired or depressed or whatever it is, or struggling, or they need to hand the kids off to you, you can't tell them to slag off. You've got to step up and take care of your mate. And so I'd like to believe, and I believe Julie feels this way, that even though I've been gone so much, when I am home, even sometimes when I'm away, it was so clear to her how dialed in I was. You know, the joke is like I could be with Rebels in the Niger Delta on a boat and I'd be texting her, don't forget about the orthodontist appointment at 3 o'clock today for Isabel.
Right.
You know, so I think that went a really long way in making her feel that I hadn't just left her alone. But she's also an extraordinary person. And you know, regardless of gender orientation or whatever your coupling is, if you're going to do this and you're going to be away a lot, you need to have a special mate who can be independent and strong enough to be alone a lot and recognize that this is who you are. And if you don't do this, then you'll probably be even more miserable to be around.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And your kids are quite grown up now, but they, you know, how do they feel about your absence? Are they okay with it?
Yeah, well, they're gone. We're empty nesters. So, you know, they're 20 and 23. They're in college, university.
So they are fully, grown up.
And they're doing great, and thank goodness. And, you know, I think it's something I worried about more than I think they did. I mean, I can't speak for them. That's my sense. We're pretty close and we talk a lot. But I think I worried more about the impact of my absences than they did, because their lives, again, because of Julie and the way we have parented and structured our lives, they've had a good life.
Right.
They're not left for wanting. They know they're loved like mad, you know? So, you know, but sure, did I miss things? Was I not there? Or even when I was home, was I burnt out or distracted? Sure. But, so yeah, it's an interesting dynamic, yeah. That one.
Well, I think you said it was a tendency for you to overcompensate when you did get back.
Yeah. So it's really interesting now. So, you know, I was just saying when we began talking, you know, how I hit this wall last month in Peru, and I was really, it was dark, right? And I actually reached out to my 23-year-old son and texting him, just, you know, he'd be like, hey, how's it going? I was like, oh, it's rough, you know? And it's always tricky, you know, to lay on too much of your own crap on your kids, you know, you don't want to burden them. But I said, you know, I'm really having a rough time. And, you know, we went back and forth a little bit. And then he was like, well, you got it. You know, like, he was like amazing. It was like roles reversal. And he was like, come on, Dad, you got to get it together, stick with it, all that. And then he was like, you know, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I think maybe I should take a writing class. And then, like, the next morning, he had sent me all these links to online writing classes. And I was like, oh, my God. Mm. Am I, like, the luckiest person on earth?
Yeah.
And I signed up for one of them.
Wow. So he's sort of, like you say, the tables are turned to some extent.
Yeah.
But it's probably a testament to your parenting skills that he's like that. Because, obviously, yeah, he's obviously had a good role model.
Yeah.
But, what, I mean, like, one of the things you said was... I spent half my life in hotel rooms alone. There's a loneliness in that. But when I come home, I sometimes feel even more lonely. So kind of, can you explain what you meant by that?
Sure. So, okay, let me paint a scenario. Oh, my God, there's a bazillion of them to do. But I've just come back from 10 weeks in Iraq and Afghanistan. And literally, I've, like, sat down at the dinner table a few hours later. Nobody asked me anything about where I've been. They're not asking me, how are you doing? They're not asking me, so tell me a story. And you're sitting there with the three people that you love the most on earth in this intimate moment, and you realize I'm an apparition to them. Well, that's my interpretation. Obviously, that's not how they saw it. Mm. They're in their lives. It's another dinner. They've got schoolwork or whatever, you know, they've got their social life. You know, mom has created an environment where, you know, things are just marching along. And then I'd sit there, and there were times where it was so painful for me, because it's sort of like you've built up for 10 weeks. I can't wait until this moment. And then you're in that moment and you realize it's not that they don't care, but it's hard not to feel like they don't care.
Right.
And then you think, what the hell is going on? I mean, there were times where I'd have to leave the house and just walk, because I was so angry and so frustrated and so confused. So, you know, that's an example of that, you know. And I think, and sort of get back when something you said about where I would overcompensate, you know, that would be a case where we're in the house and everything is fine. Like, you would look at this picture and go, this is a perfect vision of, like, domesticity, and I'm raging because nobody wants, you know, everyone's on their doing their own thing and they're not with me.
Right.
So I guess it's this sort of, like, unending need to be connected.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, yeah, so it's a tricky one. It's a tricky one.
Does being in Seven help with that connection? Is it a kind of a family vibe? I can imagine being with an agency like Seven would give you some of that.
Yeah, so I mean, it's mixed. It's, you know, they're of the whatever, now we're up to 28 people. I mean, there's certainly a handful, a core of people in Seven who I know that virtually at any time I could reach out to, and they will be there for me, you know. And if it's something really heavy, you know, they'll be there, and they can also counsel me, you know, that there's this collective wisdom, you know. So there's certain people I might go to for very specific things if I need help, but I also know there's limits,
right?
Because ultimately they're not my family, and I'm not their family.
Sure.
Or they have their own families.
Yeah, yeah. Or, and everyone's dealing with the same issues. But in terms of, I guess, you know, if you're interested in getting an opinion on your work, who do you go to, or who, you know, which mentors have you had over the years? Who are the people who kind of fulfilled that role, the role that you're sort of now fulfilling for the younger generation yourself?
And I've never had a mentor.
Have you not?
I know. We were just talking about this earlier with someone here where we are. And
yeah.
No, I grew up at a different time in this profession. I never assisted anyone. I never did workshops. I never had a mentor. I just hit the ground and just worked my ass off. And it's interesting because I've always sort of felt like I'd like to have someone, even at this stage in my life, where, you know, to have that kind of feedback. And this is the key thing about being a mentor is you need to be tough and honest, but you need to be loving and supportive. And your job as a mentor is not to make your mentee into you.
Right.
It's to try to understand who they are and where they want to go, and find a way to give them that support or encouragement or nudge, you know. So anyway, so yeah, I mean, but having said that, you know what? You could mentor me. I mean, no, you know, like I'm a whore when it comes to mentoring. That didn't sound very good. But you know, I mean, like I'm open to mentoring. So in some weird way, I think I maybe have found a way to sort of surreptitiously get mentoring.
Yeah.
You know, so and let's say it could be people in Seven, which would be probably the most prime example, where it's not explicit, but I might reach out to them and ask them a question or begin a line of inquiry that is really about helping me figure something out, helping me move forward in something, some aspect of my work.
Yeah, yeah. Give us a sort of potted history. How did you even get into photography? Where are your roots anyway? Is your dad's from?
From Iraq, from Baghdad.
Okay, but you grew up...
My mother and father.
Oh, they both are?
Yeah.
And you grew up where?
New York. So they moved in 1943. They immigrated to New York. Thank you. I was very lucky.
Yeah.
My God, that's the American dream, right? It's amazing. And
so you grew up in the city, in New York City?
Yeah, I was born in New York City and then moved out to, you know, one of the nice suburbs in Long Island. And then... I'm rooted in New York, and then went to Syracuse University, which is in upstate New York, and that's where I discovered photography. But I'd wanted to be a writer.
Journalism was your thing.
When I was 16, and I think I had like an English teacher in high school that turned me on to literature, and I was like, you know, my mind just exploded. And I'll never forget this, and it was in combination with taking the train into New York City and looking at all the businessmen and just observing. This is, we're talking about like 1969, 1970, 1971. So you have anti-Vietnam War movement, you have all this amazing, like progressive, like, you know, enlightenment moment in some ways. And then I'd look at these businessmen on the train, and they look so tired and they look so depressed. And all I imagined was, I don't want to be one of them. Because I was never motivated by money, you know.
Right.
Also, my dad died when I was 10. So I always felt like I had my back up against the wall. I didn't have, I supported my mom in college and beyond with my other siblings. You know, so basically I was fueled by a need.
Yeah,
like I had to work.
Right.
There was none of this, like, I couldn't be a dilettante. So anyway, so I wanted to be a writer. I get to college. I'm absolved of that idea as a freshman by a really angry poetry teacher who really made me feel like shit about being a writer. And then I don't know why. I lucked out. I went to a school that had an excellent photojournalism program. And it's like within 3 months of learning basic black and white darkroom photography, I could imagine myself doing this till I was 90.
So it was that
pretty powerful.
Right.
Talking about a 17, 18-year-old kid.
Yeah.
And you know, it's what you dream of as a parent or as a mentor, as a teacher, to see that in a young person.
For them to find something that...
Yeah, whatever it is.
Yeah.
Where you just see their mind cleave open and it's like, yes, like I found my purpose.
Right.
And it could be anything. It could be farming. It could be social work. It could be anything. And what's sad is when you see young people in particular struggling and they can't find that. So anyway, so that's what happened for me. And then I graduated and moved out to San Francisco to begin my career because I wanted to get away from New York. I didn't want to become like Woody Allen, you know, sort of neurotic New York, you know, New Yorker. And I stayed there for 25 years.
Huh. And was it a newspaper sort of apprenticeship or you just were freelancing?
I've freelanced my whole career.
Right.
Still looking for a job. No, I never worked for a newspaper, never had a staff position. Yeah.
What do you tell the sort of young people that you must spend quite a lot of time talking to about, you know, how to develop numerous revenue streams in this crazy climate that we're now in? What's your kind of, you know, default advice?
Well, depending on what they want to do, because photography is a big, wide world, you know, and in some ways bigger than ever with social media, it's about finding what you care about. If you want to be a storyteller and you want to be like a photojournalist, and I don't mean like a news photojournalist, and nothing against that. I'm talking about more being a documentarian and, you know, exploring issues, and you need to create a body of work. You need to distinguish yourself. And yes, you can do that by having like a really cool looking Instagram feed. Absolutely. He says with disdain. You can do that and that power to you. That's super cool, you know. But for someone who wants to be a storyteller and wants to really grapple with serious stuff, you need to create a body of work about something I believe you that you care about or grow to care about. And then, you know, in terms of revenue streams, and it's really incumbent upon you. You don't have to, but it really is important to learn to shoot video and collect audio.
Hmm.
At least collect audio, because then it opens up your photography to all these other opportunities in terms of dissemination. And, you know, so I'm always thinking in two tracks, not just commerce, because then that would be boring and, you know, that's not the point. But on the other hand, you need to make a living and you need to be practical. So I'm always thinking about, well, how can I create things or advise people, how can you create things that you care about that will feed your soul, that will advance your creativity and your vision and all those juicy, beautiful things, but also that someone will pay you for, either pay you to do it or pay you once you do it. And the second bit is tricky because I grew up in the profession where I was 100% confident that if I went out of the world and photographed something I cared about, I could sell it. Not to be rich, but I could sell it so that I could wake up another day and do it more and pay my bills. You can't do that today because, sure, I can disseminate my work more widely than ever before. My work is probably seen more widely than it's ever been, but I don't get much money for it anymore, or that part of it. So, you know, again, as I talk about, the new paradigm is you find, whether it's a grant or an award or an NGO, a foundation, occasionally it might be a publication, your own money, crowdfunding, or a combination of some or all of those things to get yourself out in the field to do the work. And then the media is the dissemination tool, but it's not where you're going to most likely make much money. And it's a kind of crappy, perverse moment in that way, you know, because it's sad to me that people work so hard to create great content and then it doesn't have economic value the way it did.
Well, I'm going to have to let you go, but I appreciate you talking so much. It's been amazing. I feel like I've been like, I feel like this conversation has been a tiger and I've just been hanging on to the tail of it, really. But I really appreciate you giving me the time, Ed. It's been fantastic to meet you. Thank you so much.
Well, Ben, thank you.